So, about the author. And I tell you, I guess I'm starting to feel my age, because we started to study in Mark. When I look back at the notes from when we were covering those chapters, was all the way back in May of 2022. So it's been beyond a year, and these are all things that Carrie had gone over. So I'm reminded about how quickly the mind can move on to other things. So this was good for me. But so if your question was asked towards the very beginning of class about, you know, Mark not being an apostle, yet he has written a gospel, one of the gospel accounts, how would he have known? And so I'm going to just go through. Now, I'll tell you, if you actually look this up online, you'll find a lot of detractors, a lot of stuff out there of speculation. Really, you'll find a lot about that, about any of the gospel writers, that draws speculation. And I just think that's a very marked way of seeing how the devil works in the world to try to erode faith, to try to take away confidence. But what I can tell you this is that the author of the Gospel of Mark is none other than John Mark, who is referred to. There's actually some of the scriptures where you can find him, Acts 13, Acts 15, Mark. He refers to himself. You know this from there's a historian, Eusebius, one of the earliest manuscripts of Mark said the gospel as written by and recorded by Mark. So we know that that is the person who wrote it. You can also find reference to John Mark in 2 Timothy 4 and 1 Peter 5. This first point is a little bit of speculation, but do you recall in the Garden of Gethsemane there was one small account in the Gospel of Mark that is not recorded anywhere else? A young man in a linen sheet, right? And they try to seize him, and the sheet comes off, and it says that he flees naked, right? There's no way to confirm this, but there is speculation that that is none other than the young man, John Mark. As it's not recorded in any other Gospels, and who else would have known? But it could have just as easily been something that he was there present and was able to observe. So just take that for what it's worth. He's a cousin to Barnabas. His mother, Mary, had a home in Jerusalem and was one of the prominent meeting places for the church. He accompanied Paul and Barnabas on the missionary journeys. Do you recall anything about that? Yes. So, but you're both right. So he went home early. There's a number of possibilities for why he went home early. It was taking too long. It was too threatening. There's actually a lot of historical account. The region they're going through was very, very dangerous. He was just a young man. It was all sorts of speculation. What we do know very, very clearly is that Paul considered it abandonment. Whatever it was, whatever his reasons for leaving the missionary journey, Paul didn't feel like it was good enough, right? And so then you recall the second missionary journey, what happens, right? Paul and Barnabas do what? They split. Anybody see value in God's plan that split occurred? Now you have two teams of people going on. We also know that he reconciled with Paul, that Paul found him to be useful, that Paul sends him there. So all of that came to base. You see that young man growing into one who is trusted to, and he says he is useful for work. In 2 Timothy 4, that's where you can find that. And then 1 Peter 5, we know that he spent time with Peter, and Peter refers to Mark as his son. Likely not literally his son, likely speaking to Peter, having taken him under his wing and taught him and led him in the faith. So Eusebius, and he's a historian, and he studied under Papias, who was earlier, actually, again, referred to Mark as the interpreter of Peter's gospel. The interpreter of Peter's gospel. So if that helps to understand who Mark was, that he was a contemporary of that time. He would have walked on this earth at the same time that Jesus would have witnessed some of what Jesus went through firsthand. He would have spent time with the apostles and would have studied under Peter. And if you're wondering about John, Mark, John, his Hebrew name, is very, very typical. Mark was a Greco-Roman name, so Jews living under Roman occupation. So that's why he says John, also called Mark. Any comments or questions regarding the author? Okay. Oh, sure, absolutely. And I tell you what, if you, I just marked a few of them down. I can get you, there's a whole list of them. I can get you all of them. Get you all of them. So, okay. So last week we got through, really we stopped right around, kind of rushed through the end of Mark 3, verse 5. This is right after the time, and we had talked about Jesus, and it's the Sabbath, he's in the synagogue. This was a custom, you know, he would go into the synagogue, and of course we talked about the fact that he goes in there because that's where the people are, and at the very least those people have some desire for obedience to do what God has called them to do as far as coming together on the Sabbath. But that's where he's found, and he goes in there. We know it's a different synagogue from what was spoken of when he was passing through the grain fields. Luke reveals that to us. So he's been teaching on this about being Lord of the Sabbath. And what was his main teaching about the Sabbath, if we were to recall it? Yeah, right there in Mark 2, 27 and 30, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. And then we talked about the fact that Jesus was teaching with authority, and there's a man there. So he goes into the Sabbath. There's a man there that happens to be a withered hand. We don't know if he was purposefully placed there, if he just happened to be there with a withered hand. We do know that the scribes and Pharisees were watching intently, very closely. They could see the man with the withered hand, and they were watching very, very closely to see what Jesus was going to do. Think about that after the teaching he just gave, right? He just gave a teaching that the Sabbath is not, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. He just defends his disciples picking grain heads and eating grain heads in the fields. So he's calling to account some of these things that have been held very dearly by the leaders of the time. And now they're watching very, very closely. And they had a purpose. They weren't just watching to see what he's going to do. What was their purpose? Want to trap him, right? So that they might accuse him. And we get a really good look at Jesus' ability to read the hearts and minds of man as he says, verse 4, is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath? So right then and there, right, nothing else has happened. We know for certain that Jesus knows their motivations in their heart. Because that's a question that's what you'd have to know to ask that question. To ask that question. And then we turned last week to Matthew 12, verses 8 through 12, and it gives us a little bit more detail about this occurrence. And, we asked, would pulling a sheep out of a pit be work? And we all agreed, absolutely, that's work. That's work. Tending to your livestock, pulling them out of a pit. So he's calling them out for their hypocrisy, and he says, is it harmful? Well, the question I asked last week, is it harmful to see one's brother in need, have the ability and means to help, and then withhold it? Just a question. Thought about the principles of 1 John and James. And in verse 12, we said, one of the things that the people recognize about Jesus is that he, different from the scribes, was teaching with authority. In verse 12, at the end of Matthew 12, 8 through 12, he says, "So then it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." That's what we're talking about with teaching authority. He's not just asking a question for them to ponder and come up with their own solution. He gives an answer. He gives an answer as one who has authority, one who authored those laws, what was required. And he has the authority to tell them what they can and cannot do on the Sabbath. And he makes it clear that it is always okay to do what is right on the Sabbath. So that gets us back to where we finished off last week. In verse 5, he says, "After looking around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, he said to the man, 'Stretch out your hand,' and he stretched it out, and his hand was restored." So what's Jesus' attitude or response to their attitude, I should say? Anger, right? He's grieved. So you think about those two concepts. I mean, kind of like a visceral response of being upset, but also grieved, saddened, mourning, how calloused their heart is. Nothing can get through. You know, how far off, you know, I think about some of the things that would be going through someone's mind. How far off has man abused what God intended to be for their good? Everything that God had put out there for mankind, for their good, and how they have taken it, and they've abused it, and they've misused it. And so Jesus is angered, and he is grieved. And interesting, he doesn't actually touch this guy. He just says in end of verse 5, "So looking around at them with anger, grieved at their heart and at their hardness of heart, the callousness of their heart, he says to the man, 'Stretch out your hand.' And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored." So other accounts prior to this and after this of healings, we talked about this. It's not going to be partially. It's not going to be just barely. I think about the young Fletcher boy. I got a lot of them, so I'm not sure which one it is, but I don't know if you saw the one that had the little blue cast. I was one of our members here, and just last week I think he got his cast removed, and he had that cast on there for several weeks. And I went up to him and I asked him. I said, "Well, how's your arm feeling?" And he said, "You know, it's not as strong. Still not as strong." That's a little boy that can recognize that. He has been in a cast for weeks. And is he completely restored and healed? No, he's got some work to do to get that arm to regain its strength, right? But that's not how Jesus acts. Jesus tells the man to stretch out his hand, and it is restored. And that means completely, as though it was never withered. Like the other one. That's right. That's right. Yeah, as whole as the other one. So. Yeah. And his hand was restored. So restored again. That's how we know that this is not something the guy was born with. It's something that had occurred, either some sort of accident, some sort of disease, something that occurred that caused his hand to wither. But it's restored as new, like the other one. So again, that speaks a lot to Jesus and his ability to heal and to take away that which is an ailment to us. And you think about that from a spiritual perspective as, you know, we're not just barely saved, are we? When we're baptized for forgiveness of sins, it's not just, you know, we removed enough sin to get you just barely above the line, then you got to work your way up to get better and better. No, it's wholly and completely, right? Any comments or questions? Yeah, that's a really good point, Eric. Eric said it's interesting that he had them come forth, and that is what it means. Into their midst is the literal translation. I mean, Jesus is calling him forward in front of everybody. So if they weren't seeing him, they are now. And do we remember anything about what the chief priests and scribes loved in the synagogue? They loved the chief seats, didn't they? They loved the seats. Do you think they had a pretty good view of what Jesus was about to do? Do you think Jesus was afraid of the scribes or Pharisees? No, because he could have very easily, you know, healed the guy later at some point where no one was there. But he has him come forward in front where everybody can see, and where it's very, very evident that he had this conversation and he is responsible for this man's healing. Okay, so Mark 3, verse 6. And so you think about what has just happened. I mean, you think about, just think about some of our members here. Some that might need walkers, some that might now be in a, they're using wheelchair, whatever that might be. Think about what you would have observed in someone who has, over time, has developed this ailment that has been that way. And some folks we think of and we know them as that's how it's always been. So think about what your reaction would be if someone was to just be completely restored and healed. And what's the reaction of the Pharisees and the scribes? The Pharisees went out immediately, began conspiring with the Herodians against him as how they might destroy him. Is that how we would respond? I hope not. I hope not. We're going to see that they're going to have a lot of ideas for what they believe the motivations for Jesus are for these healings as we go further through. So when people should be rejoicing for the brother and this healing, the response of the Pharisees is what? Get rid of him, take him down, destroy him. Yeah, we must destroy him. Destroy. Literally, the translation is utterly destroy, bring to complete ruin, cause to perish. That's their response. So I thought about that, because I could be pretty harsh on the Pharisees and the scribes. So there could be... Yeah, we're going to see... Yeah, you're getting ahead of us. They are. You're right. They are. They are. But I thought about that. So the Pharisees and scribes, there could have been envy and jealousy, certainly could have been a motivation, right? Where they see Jesus and they see all these followers that are following him, the miraculous works that he is doing. He's calling into question their authority. He's calling into question their teaching. Certainly envy and jealousy could be at play here. But I think in order for us to really think about it, it would be disingenuous for us not to consider that there's possibly some that genuinely, as I think Eric just kind of hit it just a little bit ago, genuine belief that he was blaspheming and desecrating the Sabbath. Like they truly, truly believe that. So I think those are all motivations. Of course, they're all wrong in and of themselves. And Luke 6, verse 11, sheds a little more information. You can actually turn there. We'll just read just one verse. And this gives us a little more. It just says, "And after he stretched out a hand, he did so. His hand was restored." Verse 11, "But they themselves were filled with rage and discussed together what they might do to Jesus." So Luke gives us a little more look at kind of the motivation. It says they're filled with rage or fury. The Pharisees, which is just a sect, there is nowhere else in the Pharisees, anywhere in the Old Testament where it was called, it's not like the Levites or anything like that, it's a sect of people that held themselves above others as being sort of zealots for God, for his laws, and holding themselves as a higher standard as students and followers of the law. And as Linda got ahead of us there, they conspire with the Herodians. And she's right. The Herodians are really partisans of Herod. So think of them like a political party. So that's what they would have been like a political party of very rich, influential people, supporters of the Herods, when many at that time would have been in opposition to the Herod. So what do you take away from that? The reference to Herodians doesn't happen a lot within the scripture. Glenn, you got a thought? Right. So that's why they would not have been favored. Pro-Rome. So you can also see kind of the hypocrisy amongst the Pharisees and what they're trying to do, right? This is about consolidation of power. This is about gaining additional allies that they feel will benefit, right? Because ultimately, at the end of the day, who's going to nail the nails into the hands of Jesus? It's going to be the Romans, right? It's going to be the Romans. So great point, Glenn. Thank you. Power corrupts. Yeah, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, right? It does carry over today, right? Well, a lot of these things do. Envy, jealousy, desire for status and power. Just that genuine human nature of not liking to be made a fool of or feel like you look foolish. I mean, those are all things I think that still, Linda, you're exactly right, exist today. Okay. Any other comments or questions? All right, let's go ahead and move to Mark 3, verse 7 through 10. Starting in verse 7, Jesus withdrew to the sea with his disciples, and a great multitude from Galilee followed, and also from Judea, and from Jerusalem, and from Idumea, and beyond the Jordan, in the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon. A great number of people heard of all that he was doing and came to him. And he told his disciples that a boat should stand ready for him because of the crowd, so that they would not crowd him. For he had healed many, with the result that all those who had afflictions pressed around him in order to touch him. All right. So people are coming from everywhere, Jews and Gentiles alike. So what is this providing Jesus a greater opportunity to do? Well, he does want to get away. You're right. But it gives him a greater opportunity to what? To teach, right? He's a priest, the gospel of God. The kingdom is at hand. Right? Believe, be obedient, repent. I'm here. So if you consider just for that first verse, or actually 7 and 8, in the prior chapters, it refers to his teachings amongst Galilee and Capernaum. And now you have Galilee, the region of Galilee, Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, beyond the Jordan, vicinity of Tyre and Sidon. And between that area of Tyre and Sidon all the way down to Judea is at least, and you know, I did real good math here. I looked at the little map in the back of my Bible and the little 30-mile marker, and I put my fingers like that and did this to come up with, estimate, you know, about 120 miles. This circle of influence is growing exponentially. And do you think any person who would have witnessed any of these healings, you think they would have only told one other person? No, right? No. So yeah, at least 120 miles, probably more, between that area of Judea, Tyre and Sidon. That knowledge of Jesus, his spheres of influence is exponentially growing, and the word of Jesus is spreading, and so is his teaching. So what's the motivation? Verse 10, it starts with 4. So it talks about this huge crowd. So he tells the disciples that a boat should stand ready. Verse 9, boat should stand ready for him because of the crowd, so they would not crowd him. Right? That's a good way to do it. If you don't want to be surrounded on all sides, if you were on a boat and put out from the shore a little bit, that keeps the crowd in front of you, right? Keeps them from crowding around him. But it says in verse 10, 4, he had healed many. So what's the motivation? You know, why is... What's the reason the large majority of the people are coming? Is he healed? Would we be any different? Right, I was thinking the same thing. Have you ever had someone share with you maybe an ailment they're going through, and maybe you dealt with something similar or had someone close to you dealt with something similar, you knew a really good doctor that helped and that helped sort it out? You ever told someone, hey, I know this, he's really, really good? You know, imagine if you knew someone that just actually just healed people. You'd probably tell them, right? I can think of several people in this church that if I knew that, I would go tell. I'd go tell. This man is healing everything. It doesn't matter what the affliction is, he can heal it. I would tell everybody. So Jesus' influence is getting out. For a purpose. Is it just for the purpose of healing people? Is that his broader purpose, is to save people's physical bodies? No. It's to draw them to the gospel of God. It's to draw them towards salvation, repentance. And so motivation, many people with afflictions, that's a primary reason are coming because of these physical miracles that Jesus is performing, but he's able to use that as an opportunity to preach. And it says they just want to touch him, that their affliction might be taken away. Matthew 4:23. Let's go ahead and turn there. Matthew 4:23. And it says, Jesus was going throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness among the people. Any limitation? None. Every kind. All. All afflictions. All diseases. So, back to Mark chapter 3. The word would get out. I think about the afflictions that we are aware of within our own number. Maybe family members. Out of your love for your brethren or family, what would you do if you knew someone could heal them, could take all the pain, all the suffering, all the disablement, whatever it would be, away? What would you do? And then let's turn to Luke chapter 6. And I don't know about you, but I read this, and this is just an awesome picture to me. Luke chapter 6, starting in verse 17, Jesus came down with them and stood, am I in the right spot? Yeah. And stood on a level place, and there was a large crowd of his disciples, a great throng of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the coastal region of Tyre and Sidon, who had come to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were being cured. And all the people were trying to touch him, for power was coming from him and healing them all. I don't know what that looks like. I don't know what that looks like. But I don't get the sense that Jesus is having to have individual one-on-one interactions with each person where they're having to say, this is my problem and I want to be... Like, power is imminent. It's coming from him. And people are drawing near to him and they are being healed. At least that's what the verse says. Lynn. Yeah. Yeah. Where she's had the hemorrhage for 12 years and she just reached and touched the hem and he said, power went forth from me. I know it. So pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. It's a similar experience that the apostles have in Acts, where people were putting the sick and the afflicted on the pathway that the apostles would walk so that just their shadow would possibly touch them. The possibility of healing. So what an amazing power. But again, it all pales in comparison to the ultimate desire of Jesus and our Father, which is to draw these people into a belief and a faith to be in him so that they can be truly healed, which is spiritually healed and reconciled back to God. Any other comments or questions? We can go ahead back to Mark chapter 3.
I have a Look at David. I remember back 20 years ago, if you were on TV, if you treat your feelings, you know, try to be totally true, that there would be often, there would be some kind of freedom.
Yeah, Eric's talking about, one, we know that those miraculous powers that existed then and the purpose of them to expand the teaching of the gospel of God from Christ and the apostles is very different from what happens today. But we do have these evangelical preachers on TV. You might even see the billboard. There's a billboard, I think it's close to St. Louis, and it's like it's got a picture of a bunch of stacked up walkers and all these people that apparently have been, I guess, healed of their ailments. So I have my doubts. Actually, not even just doubts. I just know it's. But that's really a shame to prey upon people like that. So, okay. So, Mark, back to Mark chapter 3, verse 11 and 12. So for he had healed many, back in verse 10, we'll lead right into it. For he had healed many, with the result those who had afflictions pressed around him in order to touch him. Whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they would fall down before him and shout, "You are the Son of God." And he earnestly warned them not to tell who he was. So unclean spirits, can they see? Yeah, they can see. And what would they do when they would see Jesus? They were afraid. They would fall down before him, right? And what else would they do? They would shout, "Yeah, you are the Son of God." So when mankind was looking at Jesus to say, well, you know, where is he from? He's teaching with authority. Who is this? Is he just a prophet? What do the unclean spirits know without a doubt? He is. Yeah. He is the Son of God. So question is, how about us? How about mankind? So you think back to the examples of people that we've experienced throughout just the first few chapters of Mark. You know, we have some that believe and follow, some that just want to be there to see the show. Some that just want healing of some sort of physical affliction. We have some that want to destroy him, yet demons bow down, they fall down before him and proclaim that he is the Son of God. Now, how often, and don't mistake me, don't suggest that you have to be kneeled down all the time, but how often do we maybe figuratively fall down before our Savior? And everything he's done for us, when we consider what he's done for us. How often in our life do we find ourselves falling down at the feet of Jesus? So verse 12, perfect. Verse 12, he earnestly warned them not to tell who he was. So, warn actually implies his warning had a threat of an action or a punishment. That's what the literal translation means. It's not just there's a real threat that he will take action if they continue to proclaim him. So a question that I would pose is, why does Jesus not want them to proclaim him? And you can't know this with 100% certainty, so I'll give you my thoughts. Jerry, you have a thought? Other people would be after him. Any other thought? Lynn, do you have something? I think that's part of it, Glenn. Right. Consider this sphere of influence. Consider his purpose. I came here to preach the gospel of God. Imagine if he is surrounded by demon-possessed people that are the ones that are proclaiming who he is. Is that gonna help? It's probably not going to help. He wants them to hear the word. Now, when he removes a demon from someone and that person is able to proclaim, That's something entirely different. But think about, if we, today, if we had something similar, think about people of maybe less repute. Maybe it's people that are caught up in drug use. If that's who would be your spokesperson, would you want that to be someone that would speak on your behalf? So no, I think, Glenn, that's what I believe as well. I do believe that we don't know 100%. But if you think about what he's trying to accomplish, growing the influence, spreading the gospel of God throughout the region of the people, this is not who he needs to be going out there proclaiming who he is. And I think, and this is just my, me thinking, later on in the chapter, where he's going to be accused of taking action based upon the power of Beelzebul, speaks to that point, that people are going to start to draw those conclusions that, oh, he's one of them. He's with them. Eric?
I think that second generation, when Jesus said the light of Moses, not the code,
yeah. I think it's kind of a combination. I think it's kind of a combination of the two. But also, though, understand, he's already made the claim that the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. I mean, he's made some proclamations of who he is publicly. Great comments. Like I said, there's nothing in here that's going to tell you just firmly this is the exact motivation and reason. But in my studies, that's what I have concluded. But I do think it's a combination of those two. But I do believe he's doesn't want them to be the ones proclaiming who he is. Okay. So this is a really, you can read a lot about this, Linda. If you actually think about, so the question is, do we have unclean spirits today? Well, there's definitely teachings beyond Jesus with the apostles, and he's telling them of things that they need to be aware of. He talks about sorcery. He talks about all sorts of things. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that in the next upcoming class. Because we're going to talk about where he said he's accused of doing things according to Beelzebul. There's a lot of modern scholars that believe that some of the things that these people that were considered demon-possessed, don't write any of this down because it's all a bunch of baloney. But they basically excuse it away as though back then they didn't understand mental health issues and illnesses, and so that they just called it demon possession. That completely conflicts, because there's absolutely times in the scripture that accounts for people who are not in their right mind or senses, and differences when they actually say the person has been given an evil spirit and is demon possessed. So they are definitely two very distinct different things. Well, there's definitely some New Testament teachings to disciples of Jesus that talk to them about what they should be aware of to stay avoid. So we'll be handling that here in the next class. So, okay, well, that will get us through. What gets us through 12? We will carry on next week. Thank you all for your participation and for your time.